Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Treethart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, a show that, for the most part, is more interested in arts than social commentary. I say for the most part because sometimes, more and more in fact, it's hard to separate the two. Take Spike Lee's film Black Klansman, which we reviewed last week. That's about as harsh an indictment of today's America as you're apt to find at your local movie house. And by talking about the art of that film, you simply can't avoid discussing the issues that Lee raises. Same with the two movies that we'll be reviewing this week. Leave No Trace was directed and co-written by Deborah Granik, known mostly for her 2010 film Winter's Bone. And it follows a troubled war veteran and his daughter as they seek to live far from the structure and restrictions of what most of us would consider normal society. Sorry to Bother You was written and directed by first-time feature filmmaker Boots Riley and focuses on a guy working in a call center who becomes involved in a scheme that is so outlandish that, well, we'll get to that in a moment. Let's begin with a study of a man, his daughter, and the society they're anxious to shun. The first question I asked myself after seeing Deborah Granik's new film Leave No Trace was, how many messed up characters can Ben Foster play? His latest role as an outsider has him portraying a Marine veteran named Will, who lives with his teenage daughter, Tom, played by newcomer Thomasin McKenzie, in a public park just outside Portland, Oregon. Apprehended and taken into custody, the two end up living, for a time, more or less normally, in a house with Will given a job and Tom beginning to adapt to having some sort of life of her own. But Will remains a broken man, and Tom ultimately is faced with a decision: stick with Dad or go her own way. Directed by Granik and adapted from a novel titled My Abandonment by Portland writer Peter Rock, Leave No Trace unfolds at an unhurried pace. Unlike Granik's 2010 film Winter's Bone, it carries the kind of authenticity that comes with casting actors who resemble actual people and avoiding the high moments of melodrama that mark so much of what comes out of Hollywood. And speaking of casting, while no Jennifer Lawrence, whose star power helped make Winter's Bone the riveting study it turned out to be, McKenzie is a real find, playing the emotional yin to Foster's PTSD-scarred yang. Oh, and the answer to my question about Foster? He can play as many messed up characters as he wants. He does them as well as anyone can.
I certainly agree with that last statement with respect to Leave No Trace. And I would like to say something about McKenzie's not being Jennifer Lawrence. I think that's a good thing because Jennifer Lawrence became a movie star, even though we know that she can be a fine actress as well. So I'm not sure I wish that fate on this young woman. Leave No Trace opens up in a venue that will seem familiar to us because it looks like and is supposed to be the Pacific Northwest. This young girl, Thomasina, I assume that's the actress's real name, lives with her dad in this forest land. And of course, it's public land. They're not supposed to be camping there. And they have managed to make their way, apparently, not only in that particular location, but in other places. And you can see the love and affection that these two people have for one another. At the same time, you're always, at least at the beginning of the movie, waiting to see what's going to happen because you have this sense of foreboding. But it doesn't play out necessarily as I predicted it might. We do see the state has to intervene once they become aware of their presence. And we have sort of the heavy-handed conservation officers and the woman who is the social service person, who we suspect is trying her best to do her job under difficult circumstances. But Ben Foster's character is broken. And the question is whether anyone will be able to help him ultimately, including his daughter. And if she can't provide the motivation or the opportunity, or if she can't fix him, it's not going to happen. And so we see them as their relationship develops. We see them as Tom, the young girl, starts to go her own way. And the whole time, I went back and forth between empathizing or sympathizing with the two characters. And in the end, I was frustrated with the father, but I understood him too. not so sure how the veterans' experience plays into this. And so I'll be interested to hear, Dan, maybe your take on it. In Leave No Trace, we see this extreme contrast between, you know, this veterans' building where the social services are located, and then we see the freedom and the beauty associated with the outdoors. Does it need to be that stark? Maybe so. It certainly felt that way, I think, to Ben Foster's character.
Right. And Deborah Granik hasn't made a narrative film since Winter's Bone. Leave No Trace is the first narrative feature that she's made in 8 years.
Right?
Yeah, I think she made a couple of shorts and a documentary feature, but this is her first scripted feature film since 2010. And Winter's Bone was nominated for Oscars. I'm amazed that she didn't do more in between that. Maybe that was up to her. I don't know. But whereas that film, which I think Winter's Bone does have quite a bit in common with Leave No Trace, but mostly on a superficial level, because whereas Winter's Bone was almost this backwoods gothic horror story, I mean, it goes to some really dark and disturbing places. This film, Leave No Trace, by comparison, is very muted and very quiet. And it's about what isn't said. That's what's most important in this movie. And I've seen some critics, this movie's mostly getting lauded across the board, and I think deservedly so. I think it's a very good movie. But I have seen some critics sort of knock this movie as maybe too laconic or even dull, even while praising certain things in the film. But I think that's misinterpreting what Granik is doing here, because I think that this movie doesn't follow the traditional plot that you're expecting from this premise. Even the way that both of you were describing it, this idea of the government intervening and the social workers that become involved, none of those characters play out the way that
they, aren't
that
villains.
They have. No, no. They're just people doing their jobs.
Yeah.
And you expect them to be more important to the overall plot than they eventually become. Mm-hmm. And so when the movie doesn't follow those beats, I think maybe our equilibrium kind of goes off.
I agree. I felt exactly the same way.
Because you expect it to develop into something that it's not
going to
do.
And because of Winter's Bone, I think,
right.
I was like waiting for the boogeyman to come out from the woods or the forest
and that doesn't happen.
Grab
this movie has a PG rating, so there's not a lot of peril, even though I think you could argue that this young girl is in a position where she could very much be imperiled. I want to liken this film to the works of somebody like Kelly Reichardt, who made Meek's Cutoff and Wendy and Lucy
and Certain Women,
or even Kenneth Lonergan, who made You Can Count on Me and Margaret and Manchester by the Sea, in the sense that all of these films are stories that are really microcosms of the American experience.
Right.
In the case of Reichardt and Granik, they're talking about people that are really on the fringes, either because they want to be or because they have to be. And also because none of these films follow the expected storytelling rhythms, and you almost have to learn how to watch them as they unfold. Leave No Trace might not be an easy film for a lot of people. I think some might find it maybe too zen and too quiet.
Well, it was meditative.
It definitely is.
She makes movies, and this is a particular example of one, that are studies of characters and situations. And they don't follow that standard narrative of what's a three-act plot. And so we've got this going, we've got that going. Mm-hmm. Leave No Trace in particular, I think, keys for me on one scene where young Tom finally looks at Dad and says, what's broken in you is not broken in me.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you is not what's wrong with me. And she does it with this quaver and her eyes are filled with tears. And yet there's a strength there that she knows that she's going to survive. Is Leave No Trace a perfect film? No. What film is perfect? I would like to have had more backstory. What happened to Mom? She's in her mid-teens. How have they survived all these years? What was the story? And the other thing, too, is that Mary Pat brought up the whole former Marine veteran thing. It's becoming a bit of a cliche, you know, but...
And I also have to say, I saw this at the Seattle International Film Festival, and it was one of, I think, three films I saw in a week that involved a character who was most likely suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder because they were an Iraq war veteran. So it is becoming something that people lean on.
It is, as we both just pointed out, it's becoming a kind of a cliche.
I mean, it is a reality, though.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the other part of this, is that let's go down to almost any corner. You're going to go and find any big city, and you're going to find people who are struggling. Many of them are veterans.
Right.
Many of them are just simply people who've gotten lost in this so-called American dream. Those are the people who run in and out throughout this entire movie. The guy who owns the tree farm, who offers mm-hmm. them a job, looks like he's had hard times. The people that Will, the father, sells drugs to. You know, he goes right. and gets drugs at the VA and goes and sells them to these other people. They're living in a homeless camp outside Portland. So it's a study of America.
You know, it's interesting because I'm usually the one who wants more backstory. And here, I was okay with not having
it.
At one point, they do, just in passing, explain what happened to Mom. If that had not occurred, I would have been a little frustrated. It did not tell us a whole lot.
Kind of like eighth grade.
Yeah, right. It did not tell us a whole lot. So Leave No Trace is lean and it's sparse, but it's dense and rich at the same time.
Yeah, and I think we want those kinds of conversations out of characters. In a manufactured narrative, a fictional narrative, we want the characters to explain themselves to us. And you have to think, these people have been living off the land for how many years? They've probably had the conversation about Mom before. This period of time that we just happen to be eavesdropping on, maybe they wouldn't have that conversation. It wouldn't really make sense logically for the movie to stop and tell us those things. So it would have been so easy for this to be mawkish and manipulative or even morally questionable.
Absolutely.
But what all Granick does is she stands back, she lets us see who these people are and what they're doing, and just documents it and tries to understand them. And at the end, I think one of the characters understands themselves better than the other.
Right.
But I don't want to say which.
Yeah.
And there's a final moment between the father and daughter at the end of this movie that is devastating.
Yeah.
And yet it has almost no dialogue in it. Yeah, this is a wonderful movie, but you have to be patient with it.
Yeah.
And if you go with it, you'll find a lot there.
Yeah, absolutely. That was Leave No Trace. And this is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, though, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Sorry to Bother You. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed Leave No Trace. Let's now move to something just as serious, if deeply steeped in satire. It's hard to describe just exactly what kind of film Boots Riley wants Sorry to Bother You to be. At first, it seems like a study of racial consciousness as a black guy named Cassius, played by Lakeith Stanfield, finds success as a telemarketer by affecting what a coworker calls his white voice. I'm not talking Will Smith white, the coworker, played by Danny Glover, says. I'm talking about the real deal. It builds on this theme, especially during a distinctly uncomfortable party sequence involving Cassius, who rises through the ranks to become a quote-unquote power caller, doing an embarrassingly profane rap for a mostly white audience. But then the movie segues to a plotline involving workers' rights, throws in a few comments about the power and sometimes ridiculousness of art, and for good measure evolves into an overall devastating critique of how the rich exploit the rest of American society to the eventual detriment of us all. Adapting the same kind of scattershot style and script that, say, Robert Downey Sr. showed in the 1960s with films such as Putney Swope and Greaser's Palace, writer-director Riley misses as often as he hits. But behind the performance of Stanfield, so good in Jordan Peele's Get Out and in Donald Glover's HBO series Atlanta, plus that of Tessa Thompson, Armie Hammer, and the voices of David Cross, and Patton Oswalt, and Lily James, Sorry to Bother You has enough humor and acidic observation both to make you laugh and maybe even think.
Yeah, this movie is a lot.
What?
It's a lot of things at once, because not only is it just crammed with incident and with supporting characters and with little set pieces that don't really contribute to the overarching plot, if you want to call it that, but add a lot of flavor to it. But it's also about many things, as you alluded to, Dan. I mean, it's this anti-capitalist screed It's this barbed examination of racial politics and the socioeconomic things that go along with that. It skewers the art world in a really strange way. I mean, it's just got so much going on. And in that sense, it feels very much like a first film. We see this a lot where these directors, and Boots Riley, the writer-director of Sorry to Bother You, is a musician. He was in a rap group called The Coup, and their music has a lot of the same themes as this movie does. It feels like every idea he's ever had for a movie is in this movie. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. I think it works here because he throws himself into this premise and into the style. The movie is beautifully shot. It's so inventively photographed and edited. And it just has this berserk everything and the kitchen sink kind of approach that I found really exciting. Does everything in Sorry to Bother You work? Absolutely not. There are things in this movie that I think clang horribly.
Yeah.
There are also long stretches where I was completely in awe of it and had absolutely no idea where he was leading me. And I don't want to give anything away, but something happens about two-thirds of the way through this movie where you realize that it has not been about what you think it's about. And he throws one of the wildest wrenches into the gears I've ever seen in a movie. I mean, it goes off in a completely different direction. I admired it while also being kind of like, huh? And then as it goes on, you figure out what he's up to. I think the ending of Sorry to Bother You, the last 10 minutes or so, really don't work. It almost feels like he ran out of money as they were making it, because there's this big, almost like apocalyptic set piece that's almost off screen. And I think that's supposed to be the joke, but it didn't work for me. So yeah, I love how completely chaotic and insane this is, because I think for this kind of material to work, it can't be timid and it can't be staid. It has to be all the way up to 11. And I respond to filmmaking like that. I don't always like it, but I respond to it. And I both liked and responded to Sorry to Bother You very much. I think it's a wild movie.
I think that Boots Riley benefited greatly from having these amazing, amazing actors.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you really can't take your eyes off of any of them. So if you look at Tessa Thompson or Armie Hammer or like Keith Stanfield, I mean, they do really own the screen. And so that was really helpful, I think, in this process. Now, you saw this film before you saw Black Klansman.
Yes.
Because
I saw this like a month and a half ago.
That these are true commentaries on some of the same themes, although not completely. And so I think we saw them in much closer proximity to one another. And for some reason, I think that worked for me as well. But yeah, there's something really wild that happens in this movie, and that's probably the appropriate adjective to use too.
And we were talking.
But I still was able to go with it somehow.
Oh, yeah.
No. And we were talking before we went on air about some of the influences. And, you know, I had mentioned Robert Downey Sr., Putney Swope is a clear one.
Absolutely.
But the first 10 minutes of the movie, I was going, this is Office Space.
And I was thinking,
are they
Brazil.
Wearing some flair? And you're thinking Brazil.
And,
Terry
and
Gilliam's
Brazil. There's some Repo Man in there because, I mean, there is.
Repo Man,
I mean, in Sorry to Bother You, I mean, it is talking about very serious things. It is talking about the 1%, the crimes of the 1%, and how they get away with it. It's taking very obvious pot shots at people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. And it's also talking about racism. I mean, pure and simple racism. And yet it's doing it through this almost cartoonish, surrealist lens. And that kind of tactic doesn't always work. In fact, sometimes it really falls apart.
And seldom works for everybody.
Right.
I mean, you know, you have to have a certain sensibility to appreciate a film like this.
But I think it works here, and I think it's because Boots Riley is so obviously confident in what he's doing. Even though he is a first-time filmmaker, he's had this script for a very long time. In fact, The Coup put out an album called Sorry to Bother You several years ago that was inspired by the script that he wrote that eventually became this movie, and he's been trying to get it made for a long time. So you really do get the sense that even though this is a guy who's doing this for the first time and is still finding his voice. I mean, there are certain sections of this movie where you think a more seasoned director probably would have done this a little bit better.
Or maybe even edited.
Or cut it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There are subplots in this movie that just don't go anywhere at all. But there is a certain confidence and swagger in this movie that you don't often see, even from people that have been doing it for decades.
Right, right. And the one thing we didn't mention is that it also documents everything through social media. So it's a commentary on social media, too.
Sure.
There is a scene in which things that happen, that we see happen, and all of a sudden, almost immediately, they're viral.
They become memes on the internet.
Yes, exactly. And so little kids are running around with wigs with a Coke can embedded in it because
right.
that reflects what happened to our main character. Mm-hmm. And it's so ridiculous and so absurd, but there is so much value in absurdity because so much of what we see today as what is serious real life feels so absurd anyway that it takes.
So why not portray it that way,
exactly.
right? Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry to bother you. I mentioned benefited from the acting performances, but it also benefits from the fact that we don't know if the main character Cassius. We don't know where he's going to come down ultimately in terms of these alliances that
right.
have been fostered and drawn and so forth. And I liked that about it.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the end, I wasn't really sure.
I wasn't really sure of anything.
Yeah,
right.
Right. Exactly, which was interesting. It felt authentic, as goofy as it was. I mean, he has this car that is sort of, I mean, it is held together with duct tape and
literally.
And hope.
Yeah.
And, he's living in a garage.
Right. There's a running joke involving the windshield wipers and the
yes.
system that they
oh,
have
that
to
was
use
so
to,
funny.
To use the windshield wipers. Yeah. Another thing that I don't think that should get lost in the shuffle when we're talking about Sorry to Bother You because there's so much to talk about is the comedy of this film.
Mm-hmm.
There were moments in this movie where I was laughing harder than I've laughed at any movie this year.
Yeah.
There's a bit, an extended bit, involving a keypad, a numbered keypad to get into a you know, there's like a password.
Cordoned off area, yes.
That I was laughing so hard at it
that
people in the theater were turning and looking at me going, what? Yeah. I just thought it was so funny. And there's this extended bit near the end in with Armie Hammer, who I love Armie Hammer whenever he shows up in a movie.
Yeah.
And God, does he just come into this like a tornado. But that extended bit where you mentioned the rap that Lakeith Stanfield has to do, and then there's this training film kind of thing, this claymation film that we see.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, I forgot about that.
And let's not forget the voices. The voices in which
the white voices.
Lakeith Stanfield,
David
Cross and Tessa Thompson, when she does her thing, it's Lily James doing her voice.
And another big plus in this movie is that Tessa Thompson does a monologue from the 1980s Motown movie The Last Dragon. And so right then I was like, this is on my top 10 list, just for that alone.
She's going to be the voice of Lady in the new live-action Lady and the Tramp.
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it,
really. And that was Sorry to Bother You, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Leave No Trace. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot in the radio dial, and we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember this quote from the movie Good Will Hunting. It's something that Robin Williams' character says, "Some people can't believe in themselves until someone else believes in them first." You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.